Hello and thank you for downloading Witness from the BBC World Service. As part of our programming to mark 10 years since the bombardment of Iraq, today we're hearing from John Crawford, then an American college student and reserve soldier, about his experiences of the war. He spoke to Claire Bowes for Witness in 2011.
It's March the 20th, 2003. Donald Rumsfeld, the US Defence Secretary, announces that war has begun, and he has this message for America's troops.
On Monday night, President George W. Bush, our commander-in-chief, delivered an ultimatum to Saddam Hussein to leave Iraq within 48 hours. Refusal to do so will result in military conflict. In rejecting the president's ultimatum, the Iraqi regime has chosen war. You are the men and women who will deliver on the president's pledge. As you and coalition forces fulfill the mission you've been assigned, know that you will carry the thoughts and prayers of the American people with you into battle.
I don't think we got like an announcement, but we knew the war had started, number one, because we were moving, but also because you can see a great distance in the desert at night, and we could see the explosions on the horizon, the flashes from it.
John Crawford is a college student. His fees are paid by Florida's National Guard, with whom he trains once a month. But with America at war, he's now been sent to fulfil his duty in the desert on the Kuwaiti border with Iraq.
It's a little bit anticlimactic because, of course, you have tens of thousands of soldiers and Marines and their vehicles all moving at once. It's dark, and it's one of those things where you go 5 to 10 miles an hour for a few minutes and then you stop for an hour, and very, very protracted movement. And we moved all night. Saddam had bulldozers push up a large pile of dirt across the southern border, and the engineers had breached that. And so we went through that berm and, you know, saw the burned out tanks and the casualties that the unit in front of us had been in combat with the Iraqis.
The rapid advance by U.S. armored units through the western desert from Kuwait enabled them to reach Nasiriyah. Our correspondent Gavin Hewitt has been in Nasiriyah, and this is what he reported a short while ago.
The important town of Nasiriyah is tonight pretty much in American hands. There are still some pockets of resistance, but on the whole, this city now is in American hands, and most importantly, from their perspective, they have secured the two bridges across the Euphrates. What this means is that they now have the option of moving on Baghdad from both the east side and from the west side.
Southern Iraq was the most unimaginable wasteland that I'd ever seen. There was nothing as far as you could see, and we would be, you know, on, I think it's Highway 9, and you're in the back of a 5-ton truck, and, you know, there are women and kids and old men standing out there, you know, waving flags and celebrating or, you know, begging for food or water. And you would just sort of look around and wonder where these people came from. And then we got to Nasiriyah, which is sort of a crossroads, and it's on the Euphrates River. And all of a sudden, literally within a one-foot space, it goes straight from desert into these really lush crops and plants, and there were nomads, walking goats, and little villages. But it was still very surreal because it was like looking back in time. And the nomads themselves were kind of humorous at that point to us because they almost acted like we weren't there. We had problems several times with them just walking right through our perimeter with their goats.
And what were your interactions with the Iraqis like?
At that point, they were pretty limited. We weren't really comfortable with them yet. I mean, they weren't comfortable with us. Nobody knew what to expect. And we didn't get a great deal of time to talk to them at that point of the invasion. But when we did, you know, we had these little flashcards that told us simple Arabic phrases, you know, get down on the ground or where are the weapons or I am sorry for bothering you, that sort of stuff. But, of course, Arabic is a very complex language with, you know, numerous dialects. And so we would constantly run into this problem where you were trying to give a command to somebody and say, hey, I need you to step over here. And they were trying to correct your pronunciation.
He didn't realize it then, but his Arabic would have time to improve. John and his comrades had assumed the operation would be over fairly quickly and they'd be home within weeks, months at the most. But by the 1st of May, when President Bush announced the end of major combat operations, John was in Baghdad. His job was essentially that of a local policeman.
the invasion was over. We deployed to Baghdad. But even then, we were doing what we thought were stability operations. We were just kind of calming things down. And at any minute now, the police were going to come back and we were going to leave. We weren't going to be an occupying force. And we began going after criminals. People were looting things. People were stealing things. They were burning things. You know, I remember dealing with a situation where, you know, a neighbor had taken a family hostage because he was in love with one of the girls in the family. And it looks like something from a television show, from a police show. And I'm thinking, we don't know how to do this. What's more, none of us speak the language. And one of the things, you know, if I could go back, I would try to do a better job and be more understanding, because it's easy to become frustrated and to blame the Iraqis for me being there.
So you were frustrated. You were found yourself blaming the Iraqis for you being there because you were just a college student. A few months earlier, you'd been studying anthropology.
Right. And it's part of the blame, because on one level, of course, you realize it's not their fault that you're there. But at the time, we didn't know we were getting more attacks. People were firing RPGs at our position. They were, IEDs were going off. And you get this feeling that everybody there is against you and there's folks trying to kill you. And it's hard not to get hard feelings about that, you know, to be a little bit upset whenever people try to shoot at you. So it sometimes was difficult to separate everything and to see things, I guess, to compartmentalize them and to say all these people aren't causing problems and they're not the reason I'm here. You know, I'm here for whatever. I'm here because it's you know, my job. Even though I was a college student, you know, I signed a contract, and Lord knows college is expensive nowadays, and the Army paid 100% of it. So that was kind of the deal. Even though we used to joke at the time that we spent so much time in Baghdad that we could apply for in-state tuition there.
And he says it was this kind of humor that got him and his friends through.
When you have a bunch of 20-something-year-olds in a room together, it's not hard to, you know, keep a good sense of humor, because someone's always going to do something stupid.
Such as?
Just, you know, these idiotic things. My friend Boner, his name was Van Boning, had a baby pool. I don't know where he got a baby pool from in Baghdad. And he put it on the roof and filled it with water and called it Operation Splish Splash. And he would go up there and sunbathe. And from Florida, you're used to that sort of thing. But apparently the sun's a little bit different there, because you could go up there for like 20 minutes and you would come back and just have the most atrocious sunburn you've ever seen. And you wouldn't be able to put on your body armor. And, you know, so, yeah, it wasn't hard to laugh about things.
He finally returned home after a year in Iraq.
I remember when I came back, I walked out into traffic because I was so used to walking into traffic with a squad of guys carrying weapons and all the cars just stopped that I just walked right into traffic in Washington, D.C. And, of course, nobody stopped. They almost ran me over. It's a big adjustment and not having people around you with weapons so that you feel very insecure. It's uncomfortable going to sleep because you worry that something's going to happen while you're asleep because nobody's awake pulling security. But all these things kind of go away over time. But it's definitely a big change because, you know, going to war opens your eyes about a lot of things, just and unjust in the world, and very much a maturing process for me.
On his return, he published a book called The Last True Story I'll Ever Tell, An Accidental Soldier's Account of the War in Iraq. He's now a civilian working in support of the military at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida.
Claire Bowes. That programme was first broadcast in 2011. For details of our complete range of downloads and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.